Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Czech story when we come back. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, and private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? Bonds are the exact opposite to private property. Public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights. And permits are the exact opposite to private business. And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level, from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by agencies like OSHA, or the EPA, or the State Tax Commission, Zoning and Planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agents and agencies who are eating out your substance? Well, you know, there's a lot that you can do, and the first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives that you have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package and let me tell you more about what it is that you're not supposed to know about private business. Remember, it's educational, entertaining, informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call and order yours today. That number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click on the email and request your free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or give us a call direct at 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about this thing of the Czech story. We left off with the Harry Connick story, and I said we'd take a look at the Circle K story. Just before we get into Circle K, let's run over the numbers again. Remember, we circulated a check for $9 through 30 businesses in our local economy. And you take 9 times 30, that's $270. This is the Keynesian or the Keynes formula for pump priming. Pump priming, that's to stimulate the economy. The Federal Reserve is doing that right now here in the United States, and indeed other governments around the world, by printing more money and then lending it into circulation. We can do the same thing with bank credit. And so what happens here is 9 times 30 is $270, but remember, Sam didn't pay. Sam's check didn't clear. So we have to subtract $9 from $270, but that leaves us $261. Now remember the underwriters? That is, each member, each person, each co-signer on the contract had to remit 30 cents to me. So when I sent a letter out and I said, listen, all of you guys out there have to pay me 30 cents each, and assuming that you people wake up to reality, as is the example with the Seventh-day Adventist Church story, joint and several liability, if everybody pays off, which is what the law requires, then there's $9 that came from each one of the 30 endorsers on the check. Now, that takes $18 out of our $270, and then we've got inflation. And remember, Joe the barber would work for $4.50 a day, working a half a day, $9 for a full day. In this case, his greed was triggered by $13.50, $9 from Sam the barber and $4.50 from his regular customers. So the real reality of it is that paper money, checks, and credit boost prices through inflation. So inflation has a cost, and I put it down for $4.50. So if we take $270 and subtract $22.50, it leaves $247.50 worth of trade, commerce, business, and industry that we wouldn't have had if it hadn't been for God blessing Sam the banker writing that check, pumping the prime or priming the pump in our local economy and creating this additional trade, commerce, business, and industry. Now, let's take this into the real world, and let's actually test this, which is what I did at the Circle K store, 1635 in Boise, Idaho, back in 1984. Now, I took a job there as a clerk, and I worked for about $100 a week. Wanting to test this legal theory, I took my paycheck one week when I received it from the store manager, whose name was Rick, and I felt the check, and I pulled on it a little bit, and I stretched it, and I said to Rick, I said, Rick, this check is going to bounce. And this young man had been to the University of Idaho, the business school. He was on the corporate ladder of success, headed toward the CEO's chair at Circle K, and you know how young people are, you know, they go to college and they get degrees and then they hope that they can get into the corporate business world and become another Ken Lay. Well, he looked at me kind of incredulously and he said, but that's a Circle K payroll check. That won't bounce. Well, now, I guess up until this moment in time, no Circle K payroll check had ever bounced before. But I had a hunch that this one was going to bounce. And I told him so. And I said, Rick, let me say this to you again. This check feels like rubber. And I handed it to him. I said, feel that check. He did. He felt. I said, can you feel the rubber in that check? He looked at me like I was stupid. And I said, no, I don't feel any rubber. I said, okay, well, now, Rick, when I take this check down and present it at the bank and they refuse payment, do you want me to take this check down to the Department of Labor and take it through litigation to make the check good? Or do you want me to take it to the branch manager and have him take care of it? What would you recommend? And he said, you bring that check back here and I'll cash it right here in the store. I said, terrific. Cash the check right now, right here in the store. Pay me. Give me my $100. And he said, well, George, I can't do that. You know company policy that you cannot cash a Circle K check in the Circle K store. Now, wait a minute. Boys and girls, if somebody came in with a payroll check from the ABC Construction Company, we would cash it in a heartbeat. If someone came in with a Safeway check and wanted to cash it, we would cash it in a Circle K store in a heartbeat. If you came in with a 7-Eleven check into a Circle K store, we would cash that check. But it's true, it was against company policy to cash a Circle K check in any Circle K store. Now, why do you suppose you'd have that kind of a policy? What difference would that make? So I said, okay, and I took my check, my payroll check, down to the local Idaho First National Bank. And I presented it to Judy for payment. I said, hi, Judy, how are you? And she says, oh, hi, Mr. Gordon. And I put my check on the counter, and she saw the amount, and she flipped it over, and she saw the endorsement. Now, the endorsement was cashed at law without recourse, George Gordon. And she looked at that, and she said, what are those funny words? And I said, that's a disclaimer in commerce, and I don't want to take responsibility for this check when it bounces. And she looked at me like, when it bounces? So she said, no, we have a policy here in the bank that if it says cashed at law without recourse, we can't cash it. And I asked her, I said, now, why do you have that policy? And she said, I don't know. I don't know what that means. It's just that when you have these funny words on the back of a check, we can't cash it. And I said, well, have you got a supervisor? Maybe she knows why. And she went over to the supervisor and she showed the supervisor the check. Now they're, you know, a few steps away from the counter. And the supervisor looked over at me and I smiled back. And she looked at the check and she listened to Judy. And then she looked over at me and I smiled back. And then she looked at the check and she looked at Judy and she listened some more. And she looked at me and I smiled back. And she came over and she says, oh, Mr. Gordon, we can't cash this check. It's against bank policy. And I asked her, I said, why is it against bank policy to cash a check that says cashed at law without recourse? And she said she didn't know. She did not know. She just knew that she was instructed not to cash it. But she said, listen, here's what we can do to solve your problem. And she handed me a signature card. And she said, here, just fill out the signature card. And we will open a checking account for you. You deposit this check into your account. Then you write a check on your account to the bank for cash. And we will cash this check and give you the $100 in cash. Now, did you all follow that maneuver? If I open an account, I sign the signature card. I become a partner. I become a member of the bank, just like the man who joined the Seventh-day Adventist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Then deposit the Circle K check in your account. Write a counter check for cash on your account. Sign the check. Give it to me, and we will cash your check, Mr. Gordon. I said, gee, that's a lot of paperwork, and I really don't want to do business with the bank. I really don't want to be a member of the bank. I don't want to contract under Title 31 and Title 12 and the Banking Acts of Idaho with this bank, the Idaho First National Bank. I just want to get paid. See, I already gave them my 40 hours of labor. See, they've already collected my labor, and now they've given me this check as consideration on our contract, and they said that I could bring this to the bank and that you would cash it. Now, it's my understanding that somewhere back there in the vault, there's a little box marked Circle K full of $100 bills. And Circle K writes little notes like this one here that says, pay to the order of little Georgie Gordon $100. Now, here I am, little Georgie Gordon, and I am ordering you to pay me $100 out of the Circle K box. And she said, well, that's kind of simplistic, Mr. Gordon. That isn't quite the way it works, but I see what you're getting at. But, Mr. Gordon, it's bank policy. And I said, what does your bank policy have to do with your obligation to your customer, Circle K, who is instructing you to pay me $100 out of their monies. Is it because Circle K doesn't have any money and that Circle K is in reality an insolvent upon national bank credit? And she said, huh? I said, is Circle K an insolvent upon national bank credit? That is, they don't have any money, but they have a lot of credit. And they're engaged in a guardian ward relationship with the bank. And the bank, acting as their guardian, is protecting them and the bank against me because I'm not a member of the club. I'm not a member of the banking institution. And she looked at me like I was Mork from work, and she said, I don't even know what you're talking about. I said, oh, okay. Well, who here in the bank could answer the question why, as to why it is you won't cash the check because it's got the disclaimer cashed at law without recourse? And she said, well, I don't know. You'll have to take it to the bank manager. So she took me over to the bank manager, an older woman, probably in her 60s, which to me at that time was an old lady. But, you know, now that I'm pushing 70, you know, 60 doesn't seem to be quite as old as it was when I was in my 40s. So anyway, I took the check over to the branch manager along with the supervisor, and the supervisor introduced me to the branch manager and said, we have a problem with a check with a disclaimer on it, and I can't explain it. And so the branch manager said, well, let me see that. And so she took the check, and she looked at it, and she said, well, it's against bank policy to cash a check with a disclaimer. And I said, well, could you tell me why? And she said, well, yes, I think I can. And she said, here's the legal ramifications, the position that you put the bank in the event that this check isn't any good. Now notice, she says, in the event that the check isn't any good, if the check bounced. And I said, well, say on. And she went on to explain. She said, well, suppose that Circle K were to close its doors tonight after closing time, and then they filed for bankruptcy. And let's suppose that we've already cashed this check for you, then we would be the holder in due course with the check that we would have to present to the bankruptcy court as an unsecured creditor. And after all of the Circle K assets were sold, we might get 10 or 15 cents on the dollar for this asset. So I said, the check is an asset, and I'm holding the asset, which is worth 100 cents on the dollar, as long as I endorse it and guarantee it. And she said, that's correct. So when you endorse the check, you become a co-signer on the check, just like Joe the barber becomes a co-signer with Sam the banker and guarantees Sam the banker's credit. So I made this observation. I said, well, how do I know that Circle K has any money in the bank? And she says, well, you don't. And I said, then what everybody is expecting me to do is to accept on faith that Circle K has $100 in the bank, endorse the back of the check, and guarantee Circle K's check, so that if it bounces, you have recourse to me and you can take the money out of my account. And she said, that's exactly correct. All right, now let's follow this through. Have you ever taken a check, deposited in your account, and had it bounce? Where does the bank go to collect the funds? Well, they go right back to your checking account and take it right out of your account. And that's what recourse is all about. Now, when you cash a check and you put the endorsement on, restricted, cashed at law without recourse, you're saying, in effect, well, you don't have any recourse to me, and I'm not going to guarantee this check. If it bounces, too bad. Well, the bank looks at that and says, well, if you're not going to guarantee the check and we certify it, then we have to guarantee it. And if it bounces, then we take the loss, and we don't want to take that loss. And I'll just picture this. You're a working stiff, working, let's say, for General Motors. And on Friday, General Motors hands you your paycheck. You take it down to the bank and endorse it and guarantee General Motors credit. Now, General Motors already has your 40 hours of labor. They don't pay you for the 40 hours of labor. What they do is discharge you with their check, which is a promise to pay, if you guarantee their credit. If you promise that if their check bounces, you'll make it good, that you're going to be an underwriter of General Motors credit. And I looked at that and I said, why do I want to guarantee Circle K's credit? Well, it's the economic system. Well, okay, that may be the economic system, but then why do I want to participate in a system in which I give you my labor, and you don't pay me, you discharge me, and then make me guarantee your credit? Why should I be a surety underwriter for Circle K or General Motors? Well, because it's the economic system. Well, the economic system, boys and girls, is based upon fiat paper, Federal Reserve note fiat paper. It's not based upon gold and silver. It's not based upon property and property rights. Or it's not based upon the common law. It's based upon the Roman civil law. It's based upon surety, contract. And a contract, remember, is an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. And contracts can be express or implied. Now, an implied contract is a contract that we call an adhesion contract. It isn't something that you knew about or had expressly explained to you, or that you saw it in spades in writing. It is something that you have, that you're obligated to, that you're a party to, that you know nothing about. So I left the bank and I took the check back to Circle K, and I said to Rick, the store manager, I said, well, the check bounced. The bank will not cash this check. And Rick was just thunderstruck. He said, that can't be. That's not right. That just can't be right. And I said, well, there it is. Now, my recourse has to be with the Department of Labor or with our branch manager. Which would you prefer that I take this to? And he said, give it to me. I'll go ahead and cash it. I'll take it up with our branch manager, and I'll see what this is all about. I don't understand what's going on here, George. So he took the check, and he stamped it on the back with the Circle K deposit stamp. It says, for deposit only, Circle K Corporation, store number 1635. And he gave me five $20 bills and some change. I've got my money. I'm happy. I've been cashed out. He took the check, and he put it into the regular deposit. He delivered that to the bank, made his store deposit. And then the following week, now I only worked weekends here, so I didn't see Rick until the following Friday. I came tripping into the store. And as I came by the cash register, he said, George, wait a minute. I got to talk to you. And I said, what's going on, Rick? And he said, you remember your payroll check last Friday? I said, yeah. He said, it bounced. I said, yeah, I know. I told you it wasn't any good. And he said, you know those funny words that you put on the back of it? That's the second guy, Judy, called him funny words, and so did Rick. He said, those funny words. I said, what funny words? He said, well, I can't remember what it said, but whatever it was that you put on your check, don't ever do that again. I said, well, what happened, Rick? Tell me the story. And he said, well, I had a $100 shortage in my deposit because that check bounced, and I was written up in my personnel file for embezzling the $100 that amounted to your payroll check. And I said, well, I'm really surprised, Rick. Why did you embezzle $100? He said, no, wait a minute. You know I didn't embezzle $100. And I said, well, Rick, you knew it was against company policy to cash a Circle K payroll check in a Circle K store. He said, yeah, but I didn't understand why. I said, well, do you understand now? And he said, no. Now, here's the guy who just went through the experience. And when I asked him, I said, well, now do you understand? He said, no. This is a kid who's been to the university. He has a degree in business administration. He's a store manager. He didn't understand it even after it happened to him. So sharpen your pencil now, children, on both ends. Let's see if we can grasp this. The Circle K Corporation doesn't have any money. Neither does General Motors or Ford or Bill Gates. Those people don't have any money. They don't deal in money. They deal in credit. Now, they've got lots of credit, and they use their credit to buy goods with, but they don't own any of the things that they buy any more than little Georgie Gordon owns the bread and milk when he's walking up the street. He's an agent in possession. He's the holder in due course, but he doesn't own the bread and milk. Somebody else owns it. Now, as a matter of law, and again, don't get angry with me because I don't make these laws and I don't write them. I don't approve of them. I think that they're pretty poor, but, you know, here's this law over here called the Uniform Commercial Code, which has replaced thou shalt not steal and property and property rights. And Americans have rejected the Ten Commandments. We threw the Ten Commandments out of our public schools. We threw them out of our business. We threw them out of our government. We threw God and the Ten Commandments out of our public institutions. Remember, we've established separation of church and state. We're not going to have God or the Ten Commandments or thou shalt not steal or just weights and balances getting in the way of our Securities and Exchange Commission or of our stock markets or of our credit cards and our banking practices. So Rick had a $100 deposit that he put into his store deposit out of the Circle K account down in Scottsdale, Arizona. Now, if that had been written by the Safeway Corporation or any other corporation, it would be fine. But you see, it's called a float. And Circle K can't write a check on their Scottsdale account and then deposit that in their Boise account. That's called a float, and you can't do that. Banks can do it. The Federal Reserve can do it. The United States government can do it. And I suspect that many state governments can do it, but you and I can't do that. That's against the law. Corporations can't do that. So when the check hit the bank, the computer said, whoops, you can't deposit this check, so it kicked it out. The Circle K Corporation doesn't have any money in the bank. What they have is credit. And under the terms and conditions of their credit, they can't move their credit from Scottsdale to Boise and deposit it in their account. So, as a result of that, the check bounced because I wouldn't guarantee it. George Gordon refused to guarantee Circle K's credit, and the Circle K check can't clear without a guarantor. So the check bounced, and then Rick had to go down to the bank the following Monday. And then he had to write a check on his account in that amount to replace the check that had bounced. Then he had to endorse the Circle K check below the stamp that he had stamped it with and deposit that check in his account. And that way, the check could clear because he guaranteed it. But Circle K cannot guarantee their own credit. It's self-serving. Somebody else has to be the guarantor. So that's the way that game is played, and it's called cash at law without recourse. It's not UCC 1-207, and it's not all of these other Kilroy was here and all the rest of this nonsense that goes on under the guise of patriots and patriotism. But as an operation of law, it has some real significance when you refuse to guarantee a check. Now, it's very clear that as a result of House Joint Resolution 192, and from that day forward, June 5th, 1933, that no one has been able to pay a debt. All they can do is to tender in transfer of debts so that the debt is perpetual. The suspension of the gold standard and the prohibition against paying debts removed the substance common law operates upon and created a void as far as the law is concerned. The substance was replaced with a public national credit system where debt is called money. The Federal Reserve calls it monetized debt, over which the only jurisdiction is admiralty and maritime. Now, a lot of you military people can remember that when you were in the Army or the Navy, they paid you with scrip. They didn't pay you with United States Federal Reserve notes. The Army has its own scrip, and you took your scrip into the base PX, and you spent it just like money. And when I was a kid at the company store in Corbell, California, if you were an employee, a member of the Corbell Mill complex, you had credit at all of the stores, at the cookhouse, at the bunkhouse. And so you just signed your name as an employee, and then they would give you credit, and then at the end of the pay period, they would simply deduct it from your check and give you the balance. Well, that's all we're doing here. The United States of America, in reality, is a big public corporation, of which it has a lot of employees called citizens. And those citizens are paid money through their corporate franchises. And the money is the scrip that is created by the United States government through their proxy, the Federal Reserve, and the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. So the Federal Reserve, a corporation of the United States, acting as the proxy for the corporation, the United States of America, is in reality, then, a big mill or a big institution, which in reality deals in credit, but nobody's got any money. Nobody's dealing in property. Nobody's dealing in substance, which is what public policy is all about. So House Joint Resolution 192 suspended the Eighth Commandment that says, thou shalt not steal, and implemented in its place the First Commandment, which calls for the abolition of all right to property. And Americans have joined corporate capacity under Hale versus Hinkle and Wickard versus Filburn. And then you wonder why it is that you don't have any substantive rights at law. As old William Bendix used to say, well, now isn't that a revolting development? And let me give you a reminder that you are listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. And for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, talking about the check story, checks. Well, HJR 192 prohibits payment of debt, and it substitutes in its place a discharge of an obligation, thereby not only subverting, but totally bypassing the absolute prohibition so carefully engineered by our founding fathers into our federal constitution. In 2006, there is nothing for Article 1, Section 10 to operate on, just as there is nothing for common law to operate on. Perpetual debt, bills, notes, checks, and credits all fall within a totally different jurisdiction than that contemplated by Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1, and that jurisdiction belongs exclusively to the law of admiralty and maritime. So it's easy to see how these bills as plenty as oak leaves, as President John Adams observed back in 1783, polluted the laws after the War for Independence as described by Pelletiah Webster. House Joint Resolution 192 places every person who deals in the public national credit in the legal position of a merchant. And the only jurisdiction over any controversy involving this subject matter is called admiralty and maritime. Obviously, if we cannot pay our debts at law, we're also benefiting from limited liability under the Limited Liability Act when we use this credit, and that's called marine insurance. So when we use Federal Reserve notes, we engage in marine insurance acting as underwriters or surety underwriters. The definitions of liability and insure will help demonstrate this fact. When we analyze these definitions, keep in mind the distinction between payment and discharge. When you pay somebody, you extinguish the debt. You give that person something of equal value, such as you traded a horse for a cow. And so both traders valued the horse as being valued at one cow and the cow being valued at one horse. You could do it this way. You could say, well, I value my cow at 1 ounce of gold. Well, I value my horse at 1 ounce of gold. And we could make the swap in gold. I could give you my cow and you give me 1 ounce of gold. Next week I can come to you and give you 1 ounce of gold and take one of your horses. Paper money doesn't work that way. Somebody goes out here and prints up a $100 bill, which has a real intrinsic value of about 3 cents worth of ink and paper. The most important part of a $100 bill is the 35% linen in the paper, which is why those paper notes are so unusual. If you just compare those to any other kind of paper, you'll see that it's a different kind of paper. And indeed, it's designed to be a different kind of paper. So gold, then, the ultimate money, pays your debt at law. Silver does that. Wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil does that. Property does that. But that $100 bill, which is worth 3 cents and carries $100 on its face, worth of value, doesn't pay the debt, it discharges the debt. So a check, credit card, a mortgage payment, an electronic transfer, a Federal Reserve note, all of these instruments, these debt instruments, discharge rather than pay. Very important distinction now, as a matter of law. A bankrupt doesn't pay his debt. A bankrupt discharges his debts. So liability, the word is a broad term. It has been defined to mean all of the character of debts and obligations, any kind of debt, any kind of liability, either absolute or contingent, express or implied, condition which creates a duty to perform an act immediately or in the future. It's a duty to pay money, or to perform some other service. The state of being bound or obligated in law or justice to do, pay, or make good something. So liability, then, is equal to a ward in a guardian-ward relationship. Now, the word insure, to engage, to indemnify a person against pecuniary loss from specified perils or possibly any possible liability. The following questions demand an answer. First of all, who do you suppose took possession of the treasury of the state of Pennsylvania on June 5, 1933, the moment that House Joint Resolution 192 made it impossible for the state of Pennsylvania to pay its debts? And two, since land titles in Pennsylvania are allodial, what was the state assembly's authority and jurisdiction to pledge these allodiums to the Federal Reserve as security for loan contracts from the federal government? And three, if the individual citizens of Pennsylvania were sovereign under the common law, what was the authority and jurisdiction of the state assembly to pledge their labor to the Federal Reserve pool? Now, clearly, the alleged authority and jurisdiction is the so-called public policy declared by Congress, which will be addressed later. Since all of the assets of the United States have been hypothecated to the Federal Reserve pool as security for the maritime loan and insurance underwriting policy, other questions arise, such as, first, if the United States dies or is merged under a one-world government, who then gets this pool of money? Two, if the Federal Reserve dies by way of getting its charter rescinded, then who gets the pool? Well, the answer lies in the statutes. Should a Federal Reserve bank be dissolved or go into liquidation, any surplus remaining after the payment of all of its debts, dividend requirements as herein before provided, and the par value of the stock shall be paid to and become the property of the United States and shall be similarly applied. Now, the Federal Reserve is an eleemosynary trust. It's a corporation, it's a religious corporation, and under the terms and conditions of its corporate charter, it cannot be audited. I know a lot of times people say, well, how come the Federal Reserve isn't audited? We need an audit of the Federal Reserve. There's never been an audit of the Federal Reserve. There hasn't been, and then there isn't going to be an audit of the Federal Reserve because it is specifically prohibited under the terms and conditions of its charter. In the same way that Dick Armey put a rider on a bill prohibiting you from suing Pfizer, Merck, or say any other drug manufacturer, pharmaceutical manufacturer, should you receive a vaccination or a vaccine which causes you any damage. They're specifically exempted from suit. The Federal Reserve is specifically exempted from audit. Well, why is that? Well, it's a criminal enterprise like the mafia, and they don't want their criminal enterprise audited. And so they wrote it right into the charter. Now, a lot of times people say to me, well, that Federal Reserve is really bad, and the IRS is really bad, and they ought to be abolished. Well, I agree with you philosophically, but as a matter of law, you're not going to abolish these two institutions. They're part and parcel with the United States government, which is a criminal enterprise. Now, Americans want to participate in paper money. They want to participate in mortgages and usury and interest. They want to participate in stocks and bonds and the Securities and Exchange Commission, and they want to do all of these things that we do in commerce. They don't want the penalties, they don't want the hang-ups, they don't want the fraud, and they don't want the surety and legal liability that go with it. But boys and girls, when you go to Flo's Whorehouse, there's a certain risk that you take that you may contract venereal disease when you leave there. It's a part and parcel with gambling that when you put your money on the pass line, the dice may not come up 7 or 11. And if they come up 6 or 8, it could well be that you'll throw a 7 before you throw a 6 or 8. There's no guarantee that when you gamble, you're going to win. There's no guarantee that when you buy stocks, you're going to make a profit. But that's the objective. And Americans have thrown away their rights to property for the opportunity to gamble for profits. And today, you know, the lotteries in America are extremely popular. Now, the odds are 84 million to one against you. It's strictly prohibited in the scripture. Gambling is a crime, but Americans love it. And that's what they want to do. They don't want to follow the Ten Commandments. They want to follow the laws of the state, which create these lotteries and these gambling boats and crap tables. They want to gamble. People want to gamble on the Federal Reserve and the value of the dollar, and they speculate in it every day. And they want to buy stocks and bonds, and they want to do business with credit cards. And that's just the way people are. They don't like the inflation, and they don't like the graft and corruption and the Halliburtons and the Beckles taking advantage of them. But, you know, if you want to play in the whorehouse, you run the risk of getting VD. It's the way life is. Now, a fellow by the name of Ronnie L. Nixon went in and he borrowed some money. Here's the story. He borrowed some money, and then he went out and bought a house. And then he didn't make the payments on the house, and the bank came in to foreclose on the house, and Nixon came in and raised a constitutional question. He said, if the bank doesn't lend me gold or silver coin, it's an illegal loan, and therefore, I don't have to pay it back, and you can't take my house. And they went into the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals said, well, you borrowed credit. Pay credit back. Pay it back in kind. Now, when you're working for a corporation, you're not working for money. You're working for credit. And you become a member of the National Credit Commune. And you do business in credit, and you're governed by Admiralty and Maritime in the same way that you're governed by the laws, rules, and regulations of the Army as it relates to its script used in the PX. Government can make policy concerning soldiers spending their wages in the government store called the PX. It's all done by contract. Now, since 1986, we've had our gold and silver coin back. 5% of the people of America, that's about 15 million Americans, own, hold, possess, and use 100% of all of the gold and silver that is in America. Now, as a result of that, those people can operate in a different realm of law. They can have a few more perks and rights ascribed to them that people with social security numbers, checking accounts, bank accounts, and employee ID numbers cannot involve themselves in. Now, as an illustration, let me give you some facts here concerning Mr. Nixon. The mortgagor brought action against the mortgage company, alleging breach of contract, fraud, usury, illegality, unjust enrichment, and two counts of racketeering because the mortgage company did not have legal money on deposit to back up the loan, but instead had only credit and checkbook money. The defendant moved to dismiss. The United States District Court, William C. Lee, the judge, held that, one, the complaint failed to state a claim. Two, the mortgagor was liable to the defendant for $1,000 and required to pay a $500 fine to the court as appropriate and justified sanction for violation of a rule requiring pleadings to be filed in good faith, and the motion was granted. Now, the district court's role when the action is brought pro se is to ensure that the claims of the pro se litigants are given fair and meaningful consideration. Federal Reserve notes are legal tender. Private parties may enter into transactions to trade whatever they agree on as having equal value. They are not limited to gold and silver coins. Neither the mortgage company's agreement to trade its check for the mortgagor's promise to pay on a promissory note executed at the time of creation, nor the mortgagor's promise to trade check for a house implicated or violated the constitutional provision in the Constitution at Article 1, Section 10, which mandates that no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a payment and tender of debt. The allegation that the mortgage company and others committed a breach of contract, fraud, usury, illegality, unjust enrichment, and two counts of racketeering by not having legal money, that is gold and silver, on deposit to back up the loan made to the mortgagor, but rather had only credit and checkbook money, failed to state a claim. The mortgagor was liable to the mortgagee company for attorney's fees in the amount of $1,000 and for $500 in a court fine, where the claim that the mortgage company and others committed breach of contract, fraud, usury, illegality, unjust enrichment, and two counts of racketeering by not having legal money on deposit to back up the loan, but instead had only credit and checkbook money, was frivolous. The mortgagor filed more than 35 documents, motions, affidavits, notices, and memorandum, which required attention of attorneys and burden on the court, including 72 different entries reflecting filings received and docketed by the court. And Ronnie L. Nixon, pro se, Mark J. Filipoff, and Thomas F. Lewis, Jr., Jones, were the attorneys for the defendants. This case is called Nixon versus Individual Head of St. Joseph Mortgage Company, cited at 615 Federal Supplement 898, in the District of District Court of Indiana in 1985. Bottom line, when you borrow credit, or if you borrow eggs, peach pits, or eyeglasses, Article 1, Section 10 also guarantees the right to everybody, the right to contract without interference by government. There's a strict prohibition against governments impairing the obligation of your contracts. So when House Joint Resolution 195 was enacted, notice it was a House Joint Resolution, not a law. And it called upon Americans, and my grandfather was one of them, to go down to the bank and turn their gold in and take paper in return. He took his $5 gold pieces and got $5 bills for them. He took his $20 gold pieces, and he got $20 bills for them. The gold was collected by the Federal Reserve banks and put into Fort Knox. He didn't have to do that. He ought not to have done that, and many people did not do that, as evidenced by the fact that we still have many millions of those $5, $10, and $20 gold pieces that we use and buy, sell, and trade, call them numismatic coins to this day. But most Americans did, and certainly all the corporations did. And then from that point on, the people allowed the government to impair the obligation of their contracts, which was specifically prohibited. And people like this Ronnie L. Nixon, instead of coming into court and arguing substantive issues, they come in and offer these frivolous issues. Frivolous. And the court branded this frivolous. You went into the bank, and when you said, I want to borrow 20,000 gold dollars, the bank would say, well, we don't lend gold dollars. We don't have any gold dollars to lend, but we do have our own script. We do have our own checking system. We do have the national economy. And you can take that out, and you can spend that at Walmart. By the way, Walmart won't take gold dollars. They don't want. They could if they wanted to, but they don't want. They don't want to deal in them. Those are commercial enterprises. And Americans are commercial men, and they all want to protect, and they want to participate in the commercial system. The only guy that's opposed to commerce is God. The only guy that told you not to deal in commerce and to deal in property was God. The people of America, and I suspect the rest of you people around the world, are in the same boat. You love it. And then you complain bitterly when you lose, and you smile like Cheshire cats when you win. You know, everybody likes to win, but you saw what happened in 2000 when the stock market bubble imploded, don't you? And the people of America lost $7 trillion in that stock market collapse. When the market was going up, our Federal Reserve Chairman called it irrational exuberance, and the people of America loved it and bought more stock. When it collapsed, they got real mad and said, we ought to impeach the president, or we ought to impeach Alan Greenspan, or we ought to sue Kinley. You go to the whorehouse, you get a dose of AIDS, herpes, or VD, you get mad at the girls. You know, it's a risk that you run. It's the breaks of the game. Now, Federal Reserve notes are a first and paramount lien on all of the assets of the issuing Federal Reserve Bank. So says Moody's Bank and Financial Manual on page 2105. So Federal Reserve notes aren't money. They're a first and paramount lien on all of the assets of the issuing Federal Reserve Bank. Those are IOUs issued by a private corporation. I can issue those IOUs. You can issue those IOUs. And many businesses issue those IOUs called stocks. And you can buy them. In State versus Thomas, we found that first, money was property. Federal Reserve notes are only a claim on property, and Federal Reserve notes shall be redeemed in lawful money, not legal tender. That's cited in State versus Thomas in 12 U.S.C. Yes, there was a time when Federal Reserve notes and commercial paper was redeemable in gold or silver coin. Not any longer. Congress acted and said, no, we're not going to pay that anymore. They reneged. And Congress has a long history of reneging on their agreements. In fact, House Joint Resolution 192 is a reneging on the obligation to pay at $20.67 an ounce. And Congress said, we're not going to give you 1 ounce of gold for $20.67. And we're going to revise its value to $35. We'll give you $20.67 based upon a $35 ounce of gold. So you get 60% less than you contracted for. And we're just about to have a 35% devaluation. That's the number that I see in most of the literature right now. The American dollar is overvalued by 35%. So there's coming a devaluation, just like we had in 1933 with House Joint Resolution 192. Get ready, bend over, get the Vaseline out, because here it comes. So in the 1930s, we had a massive deflation. Instead of a massive deflation, all of the pundits are predicting we're going to have runaway inflation, hyperinflation. The Internal Revenue Service Code at Section 1-1001-1 states that Federal Reserve notes are valueless. Federal Reserve notes have no value. The value that you ascribe to Federal Reserve notes is between you and Walmart, between you and your employer. As a matter of law, they don't have any value. Now, how do you like that? Isn't that just real special? Hey, we're about out of time. I'm going to have to leave it right there. We'll come back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. Take it up right there, talking about the check story next time. So let me remind you that you are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by pre-arrangement, and the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Hey, we're going to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.